Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Robert Paddock for a conversation on edtech and leadership. We'll start off by exploring the personal and leadership lessons from Rob's exceptional entrepreneurial journey. Then we'll dive deep into edtech by discussing the companies that Rob has founded. We'll also discuss his current venture and what he's excited about in the future of education innovation. Now, Rob has the CV of someone who has lived multiple lifetimes. In 2007, he co-founded Get Smarter, which went on to become one of the global leaders in the market for online short courses. Get Smarter was acquired in 2017 by US-based edtech company 2U for about $103 million. In 2014, Rob co-founded his second edtech company, Hubble Studios, which went on to become one of the leading developers of custom online education content and learning technologies. Hubble Studios was acquired by US-based edtech company Noodle Partners in 2023. In 2019, Rob co-founded his third edtech company, Valencia Institute, which partners with various institutions to offer online education. He is currently the CEO of Valencia. Outside of founding three edtech companies, Rob has also been a musician and music teacher, a triathlete, founding board member of Ingenie EdTech Accelerator, co-founder of Men Who Meditate, and a husband and father of three. Rob, that is quite the CV. It's wonderful to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Monde. Great to be here. What a pleasure.
Wonderful. The place that I'd love to start is learning about you and your journey. So tell us, where did you grow up? Tell us a bit about your family and ultimately what was your path into education?
Monde, Cape Town, born and bred. I have my mother, Mandy, and father, Graham. My dad is a lawyer, specifically focuses in property law. My mother trained initially as a physiotherapist, but then actually ended up joining what became the family business being Paddocks, which I'll tell you about. I have an older brother, Sam, and a younger sister, Jen. Grew up in Cape Town, just really stunning upbringing, really. Like, I feel very lucky to have grown up in South Africa, in the 80s and 90s, through the dawn of democracy. I went to a traditional all boys school, which, Rondebosch Boys, which was an incredible school. I felt quite cloistered by it. I really appreciated the school. I appreciated the quality of the teachers and so on. But I found the nature of the learning and the overly structured, overly organized curriculum to be somewhat constricting. But all things considered, jeepers, I was lucky to have that education. And I guess what's interesting is my dad made a big leap because he worked his way up in a law firm called Febridges, Arden & Lawton. And he worked his way up to managing partner, which, you know, if you're a lawyer, that's as good as it gets to get to managing partner status within a big established law firm. And at the height of his career, he decided to make the leap into entrepreneurship. So I was about 13 when he did that. And that was very formative for my psyche to see someone take that leap, to see not only the opportunities that are created, but also the reality of what it takes to build a business from the ground up, the constant uncertainty that you have when building a business, when taking your next leap into the unknown. And I'd say that was very formative for me to see that he worked from home. So I really got to see him in action. And, you know, it's not all roses. It was also incredibly stressful. We saw, you know, what used to be long, you know, 4-week family holidays over December cut down to very short, if any, holidays. I got to see that the grind and the work ethic that it actually takes to build something from the ground up. So I'd say, you know, that was incredibly formative in the modeling that I had, towards entrepreneurship. And then, yeah, it was interesting. I off the back of school and again, feeling quite somewhat constrained and constricted by the schooling environment, I'd say I went exactly the opposite direction. I grew long dreadlocks. I became a musician. That's what I studied. I played music. I taught music. I went to London. I studied sound therapy. I worked doing corporate team building with djembe, African djembe drums. And again, I had the most incredible mentor there with a guy by the name of Brett Schlesinger, who started something called the Drum Cafe. And again, I got to see what it took for a South African to take a business concept over into the UK and Europe and to build what is now a global brand, being the Drum Cafe. And I got to work very closely with him and his wife, Sue, in building that. So that again was incredible modeling. But in my mind, Monday, I was like, I'm not a business guy. Like I want to do creative things. I want to do like freely expressive things. Again, kind of this feeling of being constrained. I want to just like break free. And that was fascinating for a few years until I got something called tinnitus, which is a perpetual ringing in your ears. And for me, that was a result of noise damage, just way too much time playing very, very loud music. And it fundamentally shook me one day. I mean, I couldn't do the thing that I had built my entire identity around, that I'd built my entire skill set around, and I could no longer do that. And this is at, you know, the grand age of whatever it was, 20, 23. And that was, I look back on it as a great blessing. At the time, it was incredibly tough. Just can't do the thing. My friendship circle is around that. My identity. Oh, Rob the musician, you know, oh, that's how I make my money. It's my whole world at that point. But, you know, without getting too philosophical too early in the discussion, one of the things that it gave me at a very early age was an ability to, I think, somewhat more loosely, hold my identity. This way that I see myself, the story that I tell myself about who I am and what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. What do I like? What do I not like? What I realized is when all of that disappeared at a very early age, who I am is actually an emergent concept. It is constantly revelatory in nature. It's a process of becoming as opposed to a process of defining and sticking to something. Because, you know, these structures I created just completely fell apart. And so I would tell you, Monday, that I had no interest beforehand in getting into education. That was not on my roadmap. It wasn't how I saw myself. It certainly wasn't what I thought about from schooling age or into tertiary studies. But it was actually the opportunity I was given was by my brother and father, who were working together in his property law firm, to come join the business to start doing a bunch of entrepreneurial activity, one of which was trying out this crazy thing called online learning. And jeepers, it worked. And it turns out that I actually had some skills that were quite helpful in that. And then you kind of like find myself stepping into things and finding out that I've got certain skills and plenty of shortfalls, by the way, but certain skills that actually worked in this space. So, I would love to tell you that it was from early stage, I just knew I wanted to be in education and that was my orientation. Not at all. Not at all. And even since then, it's been somewhat of a revelatory experience, but, that's a rather long introduction to tell you how I got to education.
That's wonderful, Rob. And I'll come back to the education a bit later, but for now, I want to focus a bit on the music. Mm-hmm. So tell me a bit more. Was it, I mean, judging by what you got in the ears, it's probably drums and Drum Cafe. Was that the instrument? I see a guitar behind you, no longer a set of drums. Yes, tell us a bit more about what music is in your life.
Yeah, thank you, Monday. Again, I grew up in a very musical household. My dad is a English, Irish and Scottish folk musician. So we just grew up with music all around. I remember pretty much every single Sunday night trying to go to sleep, and my dad would bring his three mates around and they would open a bottle of wine and they would sing and play music late into the night. When it's sitting there like 11 o'clock, you're like, okay, maybe I'm still trying to get to sleep. But there's so
that,
much.
That sounds like a rare story for a managing partner of a law firm.
Totally.
Next time I'm at Omens, I'll look at the guys differently.
Exactly.
Or whichever law firm.
But you know, the joy that I saw in my dad in that space is something that has never left me. The spaciousness that it created when you're in that creative act, and it's dynamic, you know, because you're playing music, and I think a lot of music, the best music is right on the edge between order and chaos. It's that space where you've got just enough that is stable while still taking some risks and, you know, taking a little lead melody or singing a new version of the same song, or putting a new harmony in to try, see where, if it lands. It's so alive in that space. And I really felt that from a young age. So I played a bunch of different instruments, some piano, which I'm rubbish at now, but, still play some guitar. And for some reason, percussion just really captured me. And I do percussion of all sorts, plenty of hand percussion. These days I can't play loud. I was playing kit drum for a very long time, kind of 90s teenager grunge band, playing, like, you know, Metallica and Nirvana. Some stuff that Lord knows how my poor parents put up with it. But yeah, so some of that music, and then, you know, I play Indian tabla, which is a North Indian classical instrument. I play the Irish baron, which is a traditional percussion instrument for Irish music. I mean, I kind of anything I can get my hands on, I play, but these days it's more the softer instruments or at least percussion instruments that I play. And not as much as I'd like to, but I do, especially having young kids now, it's lovely bringing them into the world of music and having that as a space to play with them.
That's really fascinating. I'm also interested in the other side of that then. So how do you go from listening to Metallica and people shouting in your ear to the other side of this, which is Men Who Meditate? So why did you start Men Who Meditate, and what is meditation in your life?
You know, it's, I feel like one of the things I'm learning to appreciate more over time is that there's been times in my life where I thought, okay, it's all about space and peace and openness and perspective. And I think that's a lot of what meditation gives you, is the ability to step back from the idea of ourselves, which is the constant voice and conversation that's going in all of our heads, about who we are, what we stand for, what these people around us are and are not, and who slighted us and who's in our good books and why are we happy? Why are we sad? All the stories that are constantly unfolding, what would be in many kind of cultures called the ego construct. But I think one of the things that meditation allows you to do is to quieten the mind sufficiently so that you can step back and access what would be called the observer, the witnesser, that is actually able to witness all of this movement, all of this mind activity, all of this ego construct, stories and narratives, with a little bit more space. And the more you do it, the more space you actually get from those stories. So that, again, it's not that there's anything wrong with the ego. We need an ego. It's important. But sometimes we can get too wrapped up in the idea of ourselves, and we take ourselves really seriously. Again, one of the things that's really interesting about meditation is it allows you to step back from that. Now, there's lots of practices that allow that. I'd say music is one of those. I'd say dance is one of those. I'd say getting lost in a creative act of witnessing an incredible artwork would be another one of those. Watching an incredible sunrise, these things that kind of take us away from ourselves to something quieter, something more eternal, something more present. And you know, to come back to my original point, there's been times in my life where I've thought, oh, that's the goal. That's what we need to do. So, like, I've gone to India for 6 months to go, you know, meditate my as much as I can. I've done long meditation retreats. I've done all the yogas and that sort of thing. Wonderful. Yes, wonderful. Getting that spaciousness important. But it's also awesome to be human, and it's also awesome to be in the thick and the grime and building businesses and encountering challenges with our business partners, with our employees, with our colleagues, to have that sense of things that rub up against us and make us feel really edgy and you know, there's this word triggered, that things around us are triggering us. Like, that's important too. We need the in-breath and the out-breath. We need both in our lives. And so, coming back to your question about Men Who Meditate, that's in 2019. And I'd been meditating for many years. I just, one of the thoughts that I had is, I'd go to like meditation studios and that sort of thing. Like, where are all the men? it really, where are all the men? Like, it seems to be very female dominated in a lot of the spaces that I'm going into. And, you know, I sit down for a yoga class and I'm like, oh my God, I'm the only guy here. And then there's a meditation practice as part of it. It's like, there's something going on here. Anyway, so in 2019 started this just very simple concept of men who meditate, which is like, we're just going to create a gathering for men. Very simply, we're going to meditate for somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes. So not huge meditation, not overly difficult to start with. But then we're going to have conversations after that. And we'd spend about 30 minutes meditating, about an hour and a half then having conversations. And depending on the size of the group, those would be facilitated conversations or theme-focused conversations. But one of the things that I found was that when men are only with other men, they are able in a lot of circumstances to drop a bit of the guarding that we have in our constant pursuit of trying to impress the females in our lives and trying to, you know, posture to look like something or be in a particular way. Chest beating, for sure. There's lots of that. And even around other men, there can be a lot of that. But especially when they see it modeled where men are opening up a bit more vulnerably about the stuff that we're struggling with. And there are plenty of struggles, that men just hold and they think, keep it stiff. No, everything's good. I'm fine. Everything's cool. And what I found was jeepers, like men need to talk. And so meditation was almost the excuse to get together. And what happened once we dropped into that space through meditation was that you actually would find that the conversations would really, really open up. So yeah, I mean, that's been running. We just closed that down at the end of last year. And not because I'm not going to continue with some of that sort of work, but, because we're somewhat reframing it and bringing a new group of people together. And we're actually going to call that Mandala. But yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by men's work, Monday. I think it's really important. I think it's underappreciated in society. And I think, again, I think meditation is actually just a nice excuse to bring people together and to drop into a little bit more awareness. The real thing that men need is to express and to be seen and to see that they're not alone in their challenges.
That's wonderful. And it sounds like we could have probably a full episode on this particular topic. It's a huge topic. I meditate as well. I do transcendental meditation. I find, to my fault, I find that I am excellent at doing it twice a day when things are smooth and easy and when I'm on holiday. And then when life gets, you know, the rough and tumble, come on, I don't have time for that right now, which is exactly the time when it's required. But I just find it slows down life a lot and enables me to be more intentional when I'm in a good rhythm, and also just the physical side of it as well. You know, life gets, you know, crazy and manic and all the rest of it, and then you meditate and you actually feel what am I feeling? I'm healthy, I'm well, my body's, you know, I'm breathing. You know, just a lot of the things that bring you back down to ground, and actually whatever problem it is you're facing is really not that big a deal in the big scheme of life. I mean, I probably don't remember what problem I had 2 months ago, right? Which felt big at that time.
You described it so well, Monday. We get the temptation for all of us, myself most certainly included, is to get so lost in our stories and you know, they start to become like action thrillers, you know, and there's the protagonist and the antagonist. These are the things that are happening and it's so real. And then with just a little bit of space and perspective, it's like, oh wow, I really attached a lot of meaning to something that actually I don't have to. It's a choice. And that's the most remarkable thing about our psyches, is so much of what we do is actually there is a choice to engage. There is a choice to allow this to run our lives and to take us in directions that end up kind of meaning that we operate at quite an unconscious level. I'm thrilled to hear that you meditate. It's a really powerful practice.
Wonderful. And your use of the word choice, again, I identify with hugely. So my favorite book is a Viktor Frankl book, Man's Search for Meaning. And the gist of it is agency. So your circumstance is one thing, but everyone has a choice of how to act in that circumstance. So yeah, let me move us on here before we end up spending the whole episode on this topic. These are huge topics and extremely important. So you added another thing now, you know, spending 6 months in India. I spoke upfront that you sound like you have the CV of someone who's lived multiple lifetimes. You sound like you've lived multiple lifetimes, but you've only lived one. Have you ever crossed the line over the course of your career, just at a personal level, from hard work into, say, burnout?
Most definitely. Jeepers. I would say that particularly at the end of our of building Get Smarter, so it was 10 going on 11 years by the time we'd sold and I was actually exiting the business. And jeepers, Monday. I mean, that was there was about a 5-year period where I was in the States or the UK or both at least once a month. Every month. And I have such empathy and compassion for people who spend a lot of time traveling for work. It is grueling. And I think the travel in addition to the stress of building the business. I mean, we completely bootstrapped the Get Smarter business from the ground up. We took on one very small private equity round in about 2015. That was really strategic capital as much as anything. But we always lived kind of right at the edge. We were constantly reinvesting everything that we earned back into the business, in order to grow, in order to drive what we thought was possible with this big vision of, you know, working with all the greatest universities in the world. But one of the things that meant is that, you know, for people, for Sam and myself, we built Get Smarter together, and he's just a phenomenal entrepreneur. You would love speaking to him. But we hadn't taken much off the table, you know, so you're kind of 10, 11 years in, you've got, at least on paper, you've built this magnificent capital asset, but you've got nothing outside of the business. And, you know, Monday, you'll know this, but when you're at the helm of a business, you always know that if these two or three things had to happen sequentially, the whole thing would fall. You always know what those things are. And so as robust as it looks from the outside, and however many of hundreds or thousands of employees you have, you know the fragility of your business. And with a business like ours that is partnership focused, and, you know, within the universities that we partner with, constant leadership changes, and it was never stable. It was never just like, oh, cool, we've got this 10-year partnership locked in and everything's stable. It's like, no, you're constantly fighting for relevance and survival, to stay in partnership, to make sure that the next course that you run gets sufficient student numbers to recoup, at least recoup the investment, if not make some on top of. So I think that the kind of 10 years of that pressure without any kind of venture capital cushioning, combined with a absolutely grueling travel schedule, jeepers. By the time I finished Get Smart, I was very burnt out. Hey, I needed a proper break. I was also being, in my language of today, I would say I was also addicted to suffering, at that point, especially in the last few years of Get Smart. Like, it's kind of, I felt like that was where my worth was I need to be working so damn hard. I need to outwork other people. I need to show that I can carry a bigger load. And that's what makes me safe and relevant in the world. And again, this is all happening very, very subconsciously at the time. Mm. But, you know, at the same time as building a business and selling Get Smarter, I'm doing like Ironmans. I'm doing like all the things that you can do that push you as far as possible. I'm trying to do all of those at the same time. And I'm trying to be a father, and I'm trying to be a friend. And it's just was too much. So definitely, I mean, I wouldn't say I had anything like clinical burnout, but I just needed to rest. I thankfully didn't have any sort of physiological, like adrenal failure or anything like that, but I was constantly tired. I was right on the edge, and I needed some space and time. And what was amazing when I did finish up, I probably actually didn't take more than like 2 months of actually just more time, more space, more rest. And I was fired up again. Like, it doesn't actually take that long. It's like, it's interesting. It doesn't take that long to recharge, at least thankfully in my case. But I would definitely say I've touched burnout. And one of the blessings of that is that now if I'm pushing sufficiently hard at a particular time in life, I can see the warning signs. I can see the red flags en route. And I can work more consciously to taper back and to find more balance, because it's not a fun space to get to.
I'd love to know, what are some of those? If we may experience them in our lives and not even know it. What are some of those warning lights on the car be careful?
I mean, for me, one of them is my immune system. Just seeing my immune system starting to dip and just getting sick more regularly. That would be one. Another one is 2 a.m. wake ups. And again, I'm speaking very personally. I don't know, you know, the science of this, but when I start regularly waking up at 2 a.m. and I find like my mind is switched back on and I can't, you know, even with techniques like meditation, I struggle to settle it again. That for me is like, oh, whoa, okay. Things are starting to spiral a bit here. I'm getting very lost in this, and my system is quite agitated. There's a general lethargy, I would say. So I've always been pretty committed. I mean, I exercise for an hour every morning. I've always been pretty darn good at that. But I start to feel a bit of a general lethargy, in life. And I get something where I'll get like a slight stutter. I don't know how else to say it. It's like, as words are coming out, I'll have a moment where it goes, and I can catch it quite quickly and move past it. But I often know that when that happens, I think to myself, ooh, okay, let's just catch that, hold that, be with that, breathe into that. and see what I can adjust in the next week or two in terms of pulling back on my schedule. So yeah, for me, those are some of the warning signs that I've observed in myself quite regularly.
Okay. Look, I really appreciate you sharing that, Rob, and lots of lessons there, I think, for all of us, myself included. If I take the other side of that, then some of the highs that stem from all that hard work. You spoke about Get Smarter. This period where you're saying you're really tired is near the end, and you're sort of exiting the business. But if I take most entrepreneurs, if I were to take a sample of 10 young entrepreneurs here today in South Africa, their dream would be build a business to a certain scale, probably, and exit, have a successful exit to a local international investor. You achieved that at a young age. You achieved that in your 30s when Get Smarter was acquired. So how was the reality of that versus how you had thought about it in your head before?
You know, Monda, it is such an incredible thing. I mean, my life has been changed like indescribably by that sort of event. It's not necessarily because it's about the money, but the money changes things radically. You know, you get to live a life that I never thought was possible. I mean, I'm here living on the coastline of Cape Town, in a beautiful house with a family and, near incredible friends, and I can make active choices about what schools they go to. In fact, we're going to be homeschooling our kids. But again, like with means, one of the things I would say is that money allows for more creativity in my life. It allows for more agency in the choices that I make. I'm less at the mercy of the system and what's just available. You know, even things like private healthcare, it's such a privilege to be able to access that sort of thing in a country like ours. So it would be just, you know, some entrepreneur saying like, oh no, it's not like the money doesn't change anything. Like I'm not sure they're being honest is my view. Like it does change things, and it's incredible. What was interesting for me is that what it didn't change was this feeling that I had. I remember sitting at the NASDAQ ringing the bell and thinking, jeepers, like I still don't feel worthy. I still don't feel sufficient. And it was a moment that I'll never forget, in at least in the way that it's kind of affected my life subsequently, to realize that, oh, it's actually that there's nothing external that's ever going to provide enough validation and enough comfort that, you know, in my case, the kind of, I guess, the psychological wounding was that I'm not enough. And that was fascinating, you know, and that for me, that's been a much deeper journey. Therapy, plant medicine, friends, my wife, others, that has allowed me to get to the point of realizing again, like, oh, it's a choice. It's a choice. And it's in a strange way, an act of faith to actually believe in yourself and to love yourself and to give yourself that gift. And regardless of the evidence that I have in my head about why I might be falling short of, to have grace for myself and to be like, no, but I am, like, actually, it's okay. Like, it's okay. I am. And whilst that sounds a little bit esoteric, I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to achieve, you know, externally some things that, you know, most people would say, you know, once you get there, then you're good. And I can tell you, it's just not. Yeah. I'm really grateful to have had that experience. And I hope that it continues to influence me as I start to feel, every time I start to feel the pull towards, you know, some other achievement as being the next thing that's going to give me the feeling that I'm after. It's like, no, remember that moment at the NASDAQ. Like it doesn't, it won't.
That's profound, really, Rob. And thanks for sharing that again. Just remaining on this topic of sort of the highs and lows of our experiences and human experience, etc. When you exited Get Smarter and a few others as well, you were sort of the one of the darlings with your brother as well of the South African entrepreneurial scene, and, you know, newspaper articles, and you're on the front page, and it's all really positive. And I remember then, it's probably about 2 years ago or so now, 2-3 years ago, somewhere around there, there was the opposite of that. There were some quite vicious articles. So you've been through it all. You've seen both sides of this. How did that feel for you as the individual, those extremes? And, you know, I call them extremes, but were they actually extremes for you as the person actually feeling it? All this external stuff going on.
Yeah. Monday, they absolutely were extremes. Yeah, exactly to your point, you know, at least at a point in time, you know, highly showcased entrepreneurs, success stories, South Africans dreaming big and going overseas and doing all the things. We had the Helpful Studios experience as well, which was very positive. And then I decided to put my toe, my, more than my toe, my bo- both feet into the water with basic education. And it has categorically been the hardest thing entrepreneurially that I've done. No question about it.
By basic education, you're meaning primary and secondary education.
Primary and secondary, yep. Exactly. Okay. I think. Thank you for clarifying. Primary and secondary education. We decided very specifically to focus on low fee private model, trying to provide a reasonable alternative for students who are finding that the public system is just not meeting their needs, of which unfortunately there are very many hundreds of thousands. And we had an experience where we had a huge amount of negative media, and we can go into the details if it's helpful about what drove that. But to speak personally, it was incredibly affronting. One of the things that I realized quite quickly was that what you read in mass media is not necessarily what is happening. And again, it's not to say, just to be clear, it's not to say we hadn't made some mistakes and so on, but you know, I could be reading something that is about me and is being published in a major publication. I can just look at it and be like, but that's not true. That's not true. But you took the seed of truth here and you extrapolate that into something completely different. Like it's astonishing, Monday. And one of the things that I've got some empathy for is the fact that I think that, you know, for modern media, if you're not incredibly antagonistic, and if you don't tap into existing stereotypes in your media coverage that activate people and get them agitated, you don't get eyeballed. So media these days is just constantly a constant barrage of hyperbole and a constant barrage of, you know, in this case, you know, nasty white guy taking advantage of poor African students. I mean, that's the subtext that's in mm-hmm. something like this. So I've got quite a lot of empathy for the media situation, which is, you know, if they don't get very extreme in their publications, they just simply don't get people's attention. And that, I think, is just something we as media consumers should all just understand and accept, that like, you're not getting impartial, evidence-based journalism that is really just looking for the truth. Most of the time, you're just not. So this isn't even about one publication or another. It's just the state of media at the moment. But, you know, I think there's some other things that were really interesting for me, because while that was going on, I was also simultaneously having death threats to me and my family. You know, pictures of my father in the street with cut out letters saying, "Get your white capitalist pig son out of the education system or else." I mean, there was some very, very severe things that were happening all around that incident. And again, you know, I'd be cautious to go into too much detail, because some of this stuff is quite hairy. But big organizations were part of a very targeted attack on us and what we were doing. We were the fastest growing low fee private schooling enterprise that South Africa has seen. And it was, there are, let's say, vested interests that would prefer that not to be the case.
Sure.
So it was very, very, very rough on all sides. My partners at UCT were being attacked for it. Some of my investor partners were being maliciously attacked for it. It was very well coordinated, and it was incredibly brutal. You know, maybe to bring it Monday personally for a second, I think one of the things that I was dealing with at the time was this feeling of being publicly humiliated. Mm. And what was interesting is that the more I tried to combat it publicly, the worse it got. And
it's like quicksand.
It's exactly like quicksand. The more you feed the media machine, the more it uses it and turns it into whatever it wants, and to suit its narrative, to make sure that it can double down on its perspective. And what was fascinating is that we had a relatively very small media kind of incident since then. And I made the decision beforehand, and this was just personally, instead of trying to fight this feeling of humiliation and try to like publicly maneuver it and make sure that I give the counter narrative and put more information back into the system, I'm just going to sit in the full feeling of humiliation. I'm going to sit with that. I'm going to be with that. I'm going to let my body be consumed by humiliation, by the fact that people might think that I'm a bad person. People might think that I've not done a good job. All these things that, you know, historically would have been just terrifying, makes me feel incredibly unsafe, makes me feel like I'm going to be, you know, exited from the tribe. And I just sat with it, and I sat with it. And at some times that would be quite somatic, and I would, you know, box the boxing bag. At other times there would be waves of tears. At other times there would be, you know, anything in between. But the difference that it made of actually just letting my nervous system experience the feeling and then noticing that if I let myself go there and I witness the feeling happening, it passes. It passes. It's the most incredible thing. And again, it comes in waves, but instead of trying to fight it and push down the feeling, no, I don't want to feel that way. So let me get more active, more agitated, more movement, more work. Just feel it. Like I'm now 41 years old. I can handle the feeling of being humiliated. I can let the feeling arise and then I can let it move through me. And then let me take action. But now I'm not taking action from a place where I'm trying to avoid a feeling. I've felt the feeling. I've let that be part of me. There's a part of me that can be humiliated and can feel humiliation. But now knowing that and being grounded in that, cool, of course, let me take the action. Let me make sure I manage our stakeholders. Let me make sure, but it's not aversive anymore. I'm not tied to it. I'm part of it. And again, that might sound somewhat esoteric, but for me, it's been very profound in the way that I've experienced it. Because, you know, it can be the same thing with the highs and it can be the same thing with the lows. It's just that typically with the lows, we try to not feel, I'll speak for myself, try to not feel the feelings and then take all the action to avoid that. I've found a completely different experience of it when I actually just let myself go there.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Rob. There's so much depth there. The one thing that sticks out from all of this is you've built multiple businesses, successful businesses, and in higher education, I find that innovating is just so much easier because it's a far less sensitive segment of education. And there is a challenge that we need to somehow overcome, that primary and secondary education also needs innovation, but innovation by definition comes with making and correcting mistakes. Otherwise, it's not innovation. So in my industry, for instance, I'm an investor. The best investors on the planet are right on the investments about 60% of the time, the likes of, you know, Warren Buffett, etc. And it's all about doubling down on when you are right and betting big. And that's how you have extraordinary outcomes. And that's the best investors, the most elite, the best companies on the planet. And Google will be running A/B tests all the time or whichever company. And in education, that is so hard to do at the primary and secondary level for a reason. These are human beings on the other side. And yet you do need innovation. So it's one of the quandaries, I think, of not only our time, it's been there before us as well. But huge admiration that you have taken on. I think you called yourself, you didn't use the word sucker for punishment, but it was something along those lines. You enjoyed suffering, you said. You can see by you going in this third venture into primary and secondary education, you definitely do like the suffering for something, for a big cause at the end of it. So the last question then on just you personally, and I've usually in our episodes, we spend a lot less time on the personal, but I've enjoyed this so much that I've let it go. So the last on the personal is you're only 41, and you've done a hell of a lot in the course of your 41 years thus far. We haven't even spoken about, you know, being a parent and a husband and that whole aspect of your life. Just right now, what are some of the big priorities in your life? What's important to you at the moment?
Monday, I'm excited about a number of things, one of which in the work that we're doing right now at the Valencia Institute is that we build technology for blended learning schooling. So pumped about blended learning and what the promise that it is currently showing for transforming basic education in South Africa. I think online only, whilst I think it's an important part of the ecosystem, it doesn't cater for the fact that for a lot of young kids, their home is not a conducive and safe space for learning. And so by allowing us a physical space where students can still come into a classroom, but the teaching and learning is driven by technology and then supported by humans, we can think very differently about the unit economics of schooling. We can also provide a conducive environment for students who are coming from very low income households. So this part of our business, I continue to be very excited about, and it's growing beautifully. The online schooling is continuing to grow really, really, really well. And then there's a third stream that we are looking to add it'll be in 2027 that I can't speak about publicly yet, but that I'm really, really pumped about again, in this space, mostly serving students from low income households. So yeah, work wise, I'm really excited about what we're doing. You know, generally I'm finding, outside of work, I'm finding just a lot of joy in being at home. I've got three young kids. I've got a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 7-month-old. So it's busy, you know, and it's crazy, and it's nourishing, and it's all the things in between. My wife, Ash, is a total rock star. And, you know, we've been together for jeepers 17 years now. So there's a strong foundation to hold the complexity and the chaos that is, you know, three young kids in a supercharged household. We are really excited about homeschooling our kids as well. So they, you know, at the moment, they're still super young. So they go to little nursery school, and that's just fun. And that's kind of play school. But I'm getting really excited about homeschooling our kids and really, really, you know, walking the talk and following that journey. Fitness has been great. I've been doing boxing for the first time in my life, which has been really fun. You know, having never been in a fight or had any sort of combat in my life, I'm finding that just completely, it's gripping me at a level I never thought it would. There's a bunch of different things going on. I have a property investment business with two wonderful partners that's been growing really well. There's a few things we could talk about, but I find myself quite
in your life. Lots happening. Okay. Thank you very much for sharing and for that extended period on you, your journey, who you are. And it was a really enriching conversation. So I appreciate that. Let's move on then to EdTech and some of the companies that you founded. We've alluded to it in part of your personal journey, but let's go into a bit more depth on the three companies: Get Smarter, Hubble Studios, and Valentia Institute. Perhaps let's go in chronological order. So let's start with Get Smarter. What is Get Smarter? What did it do? Why did you start it?
Get Smarter is a online short course business that partners with the world's best universities to offer high quality, high touch, what we call high touch learning programs for working professionals over typically 6 to 10 weeks. And the idea, I guess, was really founded on a few principles. The one is that the nature of professional development we could already see that it was starting to change in 2006. You know, in the past, when things innovated more slowly and change happened over a more gradual period of time, it was more reasonable that you could do a degree. I mean, I think about my grandfather who studied as a chartered accountant and he worked at Mobil Oil for his entire career. and then he retired and got his pension from Mobil Oil. Those stories these days are very rare. The professional landscape is changing very quickly. What you qualified in 10 years ago, half those skills are no longer relevant. This idea that we have to constantly learn, unlearn, and relearn throughout our life is something that we certainly had cottoned on to at that stage. But then the question was, well, if you want to do professional development, do you need to take 3 days off and go, like, you know, fly down to UCT's Graduate School of Business to go do an in-person session? Like, jeepers, there's quite a cost for that. Not just in terms of finances, but time. So the thesis was, well, if we could do that part-time online and we could get people to do an hour or two a day, but you could still have the best instruction from leading faculty at the universities, but you could then get real-time support from your tutors, support coaches, etc. We think that there's something that can be done here. And we were very lucky to start at the University of Cape Town with a relationship my dad had as an adjunct professor with the law faculty. And we grew a magnificent portfolio of online short courses with UCT. We continue to then do that with University of Stellenbosch and a couple with WITS. And what was interesting about that story, Monday, we thought that the Holy Grail was getting to degrees. And we did that. We actually did that with UCT. We launched the first postgraduate diplomas and advanced diplomas, which were online by any big public university in the country. And it was unbelievable until it was not. And so to speak again about some rather challenging times, we launched these three programs. We'd spent at the time many millions of rands building them out, marketing them, recruiting students. And then we got a lovely cease and desist letter from the Council for Higher Education saying, they thought that UCT had overstepped their mark in approving these programs. It doesn't form part of their what's called program qualification mix. You need to halt all activity right now. And Monday, we almost lost the business. I mean, like when I say we almost lost the business, I mean, like, we really almost lost the business. And we thankfully, working really well with UCT, managed to get that program back, all three of those programs back on track within 6 months. I'll never know this for sure, but we heard from some pretty trustworthy sources that there was some political skullduggery that was happening at the time. UCT was perfectly entitled to approve those programs. There was nothing illegal about the way that had happened. And yet someone had pulled strings to get to basically because they were growing so quickly. So, but what it did for Sam and I is it gave us a real scare about what it means to be reliant on big government agencies that we just don't we don't operate in that world every day. We don't have deep connections there. We don't understand the politics. And so we thought to ourselves, well, we still want to grow. Is there another way we can think about growing? And at the time, what had happened was that around 2012, you may remember, there was the kind of the era of these MOOCs, these massive open online courses. And the promise was free education for everyone from the world's best universities. And it's going to transform everything. Everyone's going to put their programs online. Faculty will just record their lectures. They'll put it online and magically students will learn.
Yep.
And what transpired was, you know, 2% completion and graduation rates from these programs. Very low student satisfaction.
It's like the gym. It's easy to start. It's hard to finish and keep going.
And the idea that learning is about access to knowledge is just wrong. Like we'd seen that for a very long time. There's a very small percentage of us are autodidacts who are willing and capable to actually push ourselves through and teach ourselves. Most of us need a supportive community. We need a lot of accountability and we need an incentive. Like I need to have some skin in the game. I need to have paid some money so that I actually take myself and the process seriously. And then there needs to be something at the end that I'm working towards. And of course, in our case, it was a certificate from one of the world's best universities.
So I also wouldn't underestimate the power of embarrassment, Rob. One of the great elements of having peers you, if you're at university or whatever the case may be, I mean, you want to pass, you want to finish, you want to do well around your friends.
I want to stay in the same track as all my mates. I mean, it's a huge drive in one day. So this MOOC kind of rise and fall had happened, and we're sitting there going, oh, but we've got 95% graduation rates. We've got reliable, repeatable revenue streams back to our partners. We've got abilities to recruit students from any corner of the globe. Like, why are we limiting ourselves to South Africa? Let's really dream big and let's go for big international universities. And one of the experiences that we had with UCT that we realized is that once you've got the top university, it's easier to partner with universities that are at let's call it low rankings. And so I'm really grateful we had that experience, because when we then started thinking about an international outreach approach, we knew that if we started mid-tier, if we started with like a great university, but if we started at University of Manchester, you're never going to get Oxford. But if you start at Oxford, then you can get Cambridge, then you can get LSE, et cetera.
Ooh, I'm not sure people at Cambridge would be happy about that, that ordering that you put there. You're trying to get us some enemies.
You know, unfortunately, the proof is in the pudding. It happened already. We started and this is when I started traveling a lot, is we realized we just need to keep going until we find a top partner at a top university. And so we set our sights, we made ourselves publicly accountable within the company. We said, this is what we're going for. And holy smokes, Monday, then did we start working? Then did we start traveling? Then did we just start knocking on doors and sitting outside, literally sometimes sitting in corridors waiting for a faculty member to come past so that I could just approach them? You know, like sometimes it was flying to Boston for a 15-minute coffee. It was anything that I could get, anything that we could get, and any prospect we could have of a partnership. And we got super lucky with MIT, with our first program, and this was in 2015, in fintech and blockchain, just as that revolution was really kicking off. And it completely changed our business.
I hope you bought some Bitcoin at that time as well. Did you do the course and buy some Bitcoin?
I'm embarrassed to say I'm still not on the crypto train. Hey, it's like it still doesn't make perfect sense to me. I just I've missed that one, it seems. And the business transformed overnight. I mean, we then had programs we were charging $2,900 for, and we had 2,500 students, you know, in one global cohort from 154 countries around the world. We had to triple our staff complement. We had to go to 24/7 operations. To say that it was a time of great growth and great stress and excitement would be an understatement. It was astonishing. And that growth continued. I mean, we then after MIT managed to partner with Cambridge, we managed to partner with Oxford, we managed to partner with Harvard, Jeepers, and then it just kept on moving. And then we got this phone call from this incredible individual, Chip Pausick, as the CEO of 2U, said, "Hey guys, I want to come see you. Like, I want to come see you now." Okay. And it, again, like very surreal moments to be sitting there, you know, and this is our business. We spent 10 years putting love, care, and energy and incredible work into it. And, you know, for someone to start talking numbers that actually make you think, oh, flip, I would actually sell for that sort of amount. and that kicked off its own, you know, really, really interesting process. But yeah, that was the Get Smarter business. To answer your question, the Hubble Studios business was actually initially an offshoot out of Get Smarter.
Just before we get to Hubble, Rob, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I'm just going to pause for a second on Get Smarter. And this is more a question for the entrepreneurs out there. If you're lucky enough to be in a position where your business is being acquired, I was surprised that you acquired Get Smarter for cash rather than stock. In most instances where you're acquiring a business in that kind of situation, you'd issue stock, and then you're more aligned with the entrepreneurs who are joining you. How did it end up that acquisition was for cash?
So it was two pronged. There was something at the time called a anti-loop structure, which I can't remember all the technical details, but effectively if they bought an entity which then had people within it that had significant shareholding back into the business, there was some South African legislation at the time, I think that's now passed, that prevents.
So there was anti-loop structures, yeah. So that's South African Reserve Bank, that South African cannot own stock in the American entity, foreign entity, which then owns a South African entity with South African shareholders. So a bit of it was regulation, yeah?
So a bit of it was regulation. The other part for us was, hey, like, we love your business, we think it's great, but we know our business and we know what we can do with our business. And at that point, we were actually very profitable and we knew what cash generation it could accrue for us over time. So the idea of taking risk on someone else's business where myself and Sam didn't have a seat, a majority seat at the table in the decision making about what that business was going to do or not do into the future, and therefore how that stock price was going to be affected, was just, to be honest, one day, like, not acceptable. And we were lucky. We didn't need to sell. We weren't trying to sell. They approached us. So we just decided it's not only the loop structure, it's that it's got to be a cash deal. Like, for us, if we're genuinely taking the risk off the table, it must genuinely take the risk off the table. And again, I think, 10 plus years, we'd taken almost nothing out of the business at that point. Didn't have to sell. It needed to be a very attractive offer for us to move on it.
Okay, got it. And my final question on Get Smarter is just on the completion rate. So I've done a Get Smarter course before. I did a UCT tax course online. Okay. So I've experienced the product. My wife Nyaki, I think, has done one as well, a marketing related one. I can't remember from what institution. So we've been customers as well. But what was always unique about Get Smarter was the completion rates that you mentioned, 80-90% plus, versus the MOOCs were, 20-30%, if you go back, a decade plus. What did you get right? Why were people completing your courses rather than others?
The idea we had, it was cohort based. So one of the ideas in EdTech forever has been, it must be asynchronous and students can start anytime, finish anytime, ultimate flexibility. The problem with ultimate flexibility is that none of us are particularly disciplined. So the fact that it is a cohort, the fact that we try to create as much identity amongst the peers in that cohort of their group, you mentioned the peer pressure that helps to drive completion rates. It's absolutely right. We had two other features that I thought were really, that I'm sure were very important in driving those completion rates. The one was what we call support coaches. So these are not subject matter experts. Their only interest is making sure that you've got what you need and that you stay on track with your studies. On a particular day, if you're an hour behind your studies, well, you can make that up. But when you're 8 hours behind on your studies, that becomes harder to make up. When you're 16 hours behind on your studies, that's like, we're starting to get to the point of it's impossible when you're only doing a 6-week course. So their job was to watch the learning analytics every single day and to see where students were falling behind and to intervene. And a lot of that was automated, to be clear, but it was always presented as coming from a person, and in terms of the escalations that we would put in place on the back end, if it passed certain thresholds, you would get a call from your support coach and you knew that they cared about you. And to have that person who is both your cheerleader and your accountability partner, Monday, I think it's such a critical element. For me, that's actually what is the most important role that humans can play in education moving forward, particularly with the advent of AI and what we're seeing with large language models. The role of the human is to be that warm, empathetic, supporting human who can understand you, who can see your world, and who can say, I believe in you. Let me help you craft a plan to get back on track. Let me put you in touch with this other person to have this extra session. To know that there's that person behind the scenes that is working with you is we found to be the most important lever. We then, of course, we had course tutors who are providing real-time academic support, and that's really important. we had the incentive completion of getting the great certificate from the university partner. We had the fact that students were actually paying for these programs. So skin in the game, they just took it more seriously, and a number of other factors. But again, those support coaches, I think that's 70% of what drove those completion rates.
Rob, that's really great. And thanks for sharing on the journey at Get Smarter. Let's move on then to your journey at Hubble. Again, what is Hubble and why did you start it?
Yeah, super fun business. Hey? So that actually was an offshoot of Get Smarter initially. We called it Get Smarter Business Solutions. And what we found was that there were
Hubble is a far nicer number of...
Yes, thank you. I completely agree. what we found is that there were a lot of corporates that started to approach us saying, hey, like, you know, we don't fit your typical criteria, but will you build us an online internal training system? We need a learning platform. We need a learning analytics system, and we need some content built. And we thought, flip, so what do we need? We need our, you know, our technology team. We need some learning technologists. We need some graphic designers. We need some learning designers. We've got all of those. We just need to reorientate them towards custom agency style work. And so we started doing, I think, what is often a classic thing in entrepreneur circles, where you try to be both agency and product, you know, fee for service and building the widgets that you can scale and sell. And the business was coming for Hubble Studios, but the operational challenges, Monday, my word, like running custom and building for product are two different things. It doesn't matter if you need the same skills. Like, they're different workflows, there's different customer expectations. It's like, it's the way that you think about budgeting and quality control, like so many differences in the way that those workflows happen. So we got to the point quite quickly where, again, Get Smarter was growing really nicely at this point. So we thought, geez, we've got a business here, but we there's no ways we can do this ourselves. So my brother Sam had done his honors project at UCT with a gentleman called Hannes Heldenhaes, legend of an entrepreneur and technologist. And so he came along. Basically, we set up a company together where he had a large shareholding. We had a portion shareholding. And the business started from there, and really Get Smarter ended up being a kind of lead generator, and my relationships and Sam's relationship ended up being a kind of lead generation for a lot of Hubble Studios. But then Hubble Studios built a momentum of its own over time. And so Hubble Studios basically does custom, ed tech solutions for corporates. We ended up doing a lot of work as well for universities. So, you know, a university would approach us saying, hey, can we partner on this program? And we'd say, hey, that's not, you know, we're not building a master's program right now, LSE, but I tell you what, we can build one for you. But we're not going to partner with it, and where Get Smarter takes the capital risk and so on. But we can build one for you at a fee. And that's the sort of work that Hubble Studio has done. So jeepers, I mean, just incredible partners, list of partners, Cambridge, Harvard, multi-year partnerships, with World Bank and many other very, very large groups. The total number of students served there actually is over 450,000 students. So it ended up being very big, serving a lot of students. And what was one of the things I'd say for entrepreneurs that are listening is that fee for service is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because it's relatively managing a risk up front is much easier, because you don't build the capacity until you've landed the contracts. You don't have to incur the risk until you've secured the revenue. The problem with that, of course, is that you're selling time, and time plus a markup is, there's only so far you can go. What I think Hannes did incredibly well was that we did that on the front end, but then on the back end, we would offer ongoing service, long-term service agreements for us to provide, as an example, technical support for all the students that were on the platform. So yes, it's fee for service in order to build, but on an ongoing basis, you're going to pay us a monthly recurring retainer to provide technical support on the platform. Or we're going to provide you with, you know, a learning analytics engine that again, there's a monthly retainer for that. So we ended up building a business that yes, was fee for service, but had very large repeatable retainer based revenue that came. And this company Noodle approached us in 2020, whatever it was, 2022. It was quite a long, protracted back and forth. We kind of danced quite a long dance with them. But ultimately in 2023, they acquired the business. So Hubble Studios now is no longer, it has been absorbed into what is now Noodle Partners. And Noodle is a somewhat hybrid fee for service partner to a lot of universities in the States, very much a competitor to the traditional, what we would call online program management company, kind of market. And, you know, in this crazy turn of events, Chip Pausek, who founded 2U, it was actually his business partner John Katzman, who founded Noodle. So it's kind of in the middle of a little bit of a rivalry as well between the two, but both great humans in my opinion.
Yeah, and they've been legends of the edtech industry as a whole. There's that annual ASU GSV conference, and they always feature in that. That's actually where we met, by the way, for the first time.
Yes, cool.
Many years ago. Okay, no, that's really interesting, both on Get Smarter and Hubble. Let's move on then to your current venture, which is Valentia Institute. And again, start for us 101.
Such a journey. Where it started was not at all where it's landed. The mission has stayed the same, but the, let's call it, the method has changed significantly. So in my little idealistic mind, I thought the following. Okay. I know how to build a business that serves international students, but I want to have impact on the local community. I've had the absolute privilege of growing up in South Africa for all the good and bad that is in this country, for all the highs and lows. But jeepers, you know, we can't ignore the poverty that exists in our country. And we certainly can't ignore the fact that one of the big drivers for poverty is a flailing education system. I thought to myself, wouldn't it be interesting if we could create a low or no fee private alternative to the public system? And one of the ways I could think about doing that was by creating a little bit of a Robin Hood ecosystem where I'm serving students internationally, paying dollars and pounds. And for every student that is studying there, I'm able to educate at least for every three students who are paying, I'm able to fully subsidize a full scholarship for a student locally. And the idea was, let's build an online platform that is fully online for students outside of South Africa. And then we do blended learning for students who are in South Africa. So to put that in perspective, the thesis was, let's do a internationally relevant curriculum, but let's really push the edge. Let's make sure that we integrate a lot more of what actually I believe is needed for young people to succeed in today's very rapidly changing commercial landscape. We need far more focus on technology. We need far more focus on interpersonal skills, socio-emotional learning. We need far more focus on things like sustainability, et cetera, et cetera. So we took a conventional British curriculum and then we augmented it significantly. So you would still write this British exam, but it was significantly augmented. So to be clear, you can already hear Monday, we're trying to do a lot of things here. we're trying to tick a lot of boxes, my word. And we managed to get our first cohort. This was in, 2019. Managed to get our first cohort of just over 100 students. And for those 100 students, we had just over 30 students who were in a blended learning classroom in Mitchell's Plain, completely fee-free, completely subsidized by the students who were paying dollars, pounds, etc. What was fascinating about that is that on the one hand, it worked really well. On the other hand, I couldn't, for the students that were studying, on the other hand, I couldn't drive the volume on the top end. I could get 100 students, but I couldn't get 1,000. And to really start to think about this being something that was going to drive systemic change, I realized this is just not going to work. And a few things happened, one of which was that COVID hit in 2020. So, you know, as COVID started hitting, I was like, flip, like let the floodgates open. Like, I am ready. Let's go. Yeah. But they didn't, Monday. Like, they didn't. The interest was there. But for the students, for the fee-paying students, like, we just couldn't get the volume. And what was interesting is that my assessment now, which would be partly right, partly biased, but for any students who could afford the sort of fees that we're paying for the fee paying side, they were already at schools that when COVID hit were doing, you know, online alternatives, you know, at whatever state of quality, you know, that's almost regardless. It was that they had alternatives. Where all the interest was coming at our school was from the no fee and low fee market. And I just wasn't able to serve them. I didn't have enough high fee paying students to subsidize more students on the no fee side. And it made me realize at that point, there's an entire market that is in the public schooling system that is not, to be clear, not the poorest of the poor, but this kind of, you know, in South African socioeconomic terms, missing middle, an average household income of around 240,000 rand, that sort of range where there is at least one person who's employed in the family, but they're not typically, there's no ways they can think about affording a private school because it's just, you know, 50,000 rand a year is just way too much. And that's where private schooling really starts in South Africa. There's one or two that are in that kind of 40 range. And I'm talking high school level, but you just can't access that. So I started realizing, there's an entire market that we can serve, which is in this missing, serving this missing middle population but you know, I need to be coming in at about 2,000 rand a month. Like that's the kind of area where I think I can build a business model that is sustainable, but is now serving a demographic that I really hope to affect some change for. So we did a number of pivots in the business to get there, and we ultimately launched the UCT online high school. And the idea there was vertical integration of a university with an online school. One of my assessments is that I think one of the reasons that the system is not serving learners as well as it could is because of the fragmentation. You know, you've got your basic education department, you've got your higher education department, you've got your TVETs, all of them are kind of watching their own domains very carefully. And none of them is necessarily thinking about the articulation through as clearly as we could and should be. And that was really the founding thesis of UCT Online High School. Can we think differently about the space between school, university and career? And we started in 2022. Our first cohort started with us in 2023. Was that right? Sorry. No, 2022. I'm sorry. And we became massive. Like we became really, really big, really, really quickly. And that was both exhilarating and very challenging at the same time. I think we'd made a lot of assumptions about what level of support we would provide these students, what level of accountability was needed from the parents, what level of self-regulation they would have intrinsically. And we made some incorrect assumptions. We also got a bunch of things absolutely bang on, but it was really hard, like really, really hard serving, you know, 5,000 students, 10,000 guardians, and jeepers, what a journey. Simultaneously trying to do blended learning at the same time with a number of the schools that we'd launched. It was an absolutely manic period. But, you know, as time has gone on, our student numbers haven't grown significantly. So we're still sitting at just under 5,000 students for our national senior certificate. We've launched an adult matric program, which is the need Monday for adult learners who at school going age weren't able to get their matric is massive. But they need to do this part-time. They need to do it incredibly affordably. And so we've got a platform that is serving many, many thousands of students that are doing our adult matric program. And again, we're building towards this thing I'm really excited about, which will kind of extend the vision of UCT Online High School, but I can't talk in too much detail about it, but very excited.
You've alluded to it twice, so you're whetting the appetite. You're definitely whetting the appetite. Okay. And as I think across those three businesses, Get Smarter, Hubble and Valentia, one of the interesting things is in all of them, you've chosen not to go solely direct to the consumer. There's an element of directly to the consumer, but it's all been in partnership with these, you know, great brands at Valentia, UCT, at Hubble. You mentioned some of the great universities around the world. At Get Smarter, you mentioned, you know, MIT, Oxford, all these universities that you've partnered with. Why have you chosen to go that partnership route rather than just going directly yourself?
I think it's multi-pronged. I think that it takes a very long time to build a brand in education. And yet what I've seen is what ends up happening with a lot of these brands is that they take a long time to build, but then they become incredibly rigid in their structure. So they tend to be the brands that over time start to innovate the least. And I think what's fascinating about that is that I think there's both a challenge and an opportunity. It's an opportunity to come in as a private partner and say, hey, if we work together, we can do something on the side that won't threaten your core business, but that can still provide a level of innovation and adaptation to the market's needs, that I think is what the market is looking for. What's interesting is that for consumers, we don't even know why we trust Harvard. We don't even know why we think it's a great brand. Some of us might, but there's just this auric field around some of these brands that is just like, that just provides this magnetic pull. And I think that that's something that at least from a marketing perspective is valuable, you know, and I think that it's worth doubling down on. So for me, you know, could we build brands from the ground up? Yes. I think it needs a lot more money. I think it needs a lot more time. And quite frankly, I don't think we have enough of either, particularly in a place like South Africa right now. I think we need to get massive adoption, and we need to drive very significant change. And I think brands are part of what help us do that. We're not nearly as rational as we think we are as humans. Like we have all sorts of biases and blind spots and assumptions that are not necessarily based on reality. But if we work with those, I think we can still use them to drive positive change.
That's wonderful, Rob. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, both on the personal and then now on the education that we've and EdTech that we've just spent some time on. I'm going to come back around to you then for my concluding question, and I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests. And simply, that's please tell us about one of your favorite teachers or educators or lecturers.
Oh, I had the most remarkable teacher at Rondebosch Boys High, a gentleman called Andrew Putter. He was my graphic design and art teacher. And he, from a very early stage, let us, as an example, he would let us collectively set our own projects, set our own rubrics for how they were going to be graded. And then he would say, okay, cool. That's what the next 3 weeks is. Then you manage your own time. I'm not going to micromanage you. You work your way through it. And he will be the presentation date. At the presentation date, the forum would then, of fellow students would then, against the rubric, grade the paper, provide a lot of feedback. There'd be a lot of interpersonal engagement around trying to justify why I did it that way and what I thought about it and people's perspectives on that. So, you know, huge amount of real human connection and rubbing of minds. And he just provided the container. Like, he provided just enough structure to let us get on with the work. And Monday, it completely changed my perspective on what education was and what it could be. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're so captured by homeschooling for our own kids, is that I think there is, and one of my hopes and desires over time is to continue to push that boundary with all the education that we offered, where we move increasingly away from standardized, templatized, subject vertically focused education towards far more interdisciplinary project-based learning that is peer-led, but that has enough accountability and supervision and expert support to make sure that the work actually gets done. And, you know, I think that's how work happens in the real world. I think that's how relationships evolve in the real world. It's not nearly as clean as orderly as a lot of conventional curriculum and schooling would have it. So he really opened my eyes to what was possible in education from a very young age. He now runs something called the Putter School, which, for anyone listening who has kids in the Cape Town area, please send your kids to Putter School for the afternoon program. It is phenomenal.
That was wonderful, Rob. Great tribute to Andrew Putter. And thank you so much for this conversation as a whole. It's been an absolute masterclass on entrepreneurship in education, on innovation in education, and on some personal leadership lessons as well in our own lives. So thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll continue to watch your progress at Valencia and cheer you on from a distance.
Thank you, Monday. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.